You're listening to Trek FM.
Want to join in the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners' discussion group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field, and we'll look forward to seeing you there.
This is Steve Sansweet of Rancho Obi-Wan, and you're listening to the 602 Club.
There was a little bar in Mill Valley where all the Starfleet trainees used to go.
The 602 Club.
You know it.
I was there more times than I can remember.
You're not retiring anytime soon. Are you?
Now pay attention, 007. I've always tried to teach you two things. First, never let them see you bleed.
And the second?
Always have an escape plan.
Hello and welcome to the 602 Club, Trek FM's local watering hole, where I am your host, Matthew Rushing, and I've always tried to teach you two things. One, make sure you're subscribed on iTunes. And second, make sure you leave a review. That's right. I'm so excited to be here. If you understand what we're talking about tonight, you'll probably have gotten the little reference there. We are diving into the penultimate James Bond movie for our series, since we have already covered all of the Craig films. We are going to be diving into The World Is Not Enough. And I have to say, what a great family motto. And with me here to talk this Bond film, is none other than Hot Christie, as she named herself.
Thank you for having me back. Our joke is that my mic kind of runs a little hot, and so I said, no, I'm always a little hot. But glad to be back and to talk about a movie that I hadn't rewatched in a long time, but was glad I did. I think it's still a good movie, aside from Someone's Name Christmas. But I think...
What, me?
Yeah, you. Christmas Rushing. The gift to the world.
That's all right. This punt, it's going to be happening all night, so just get used to it, folks. And of course, with us, as always, is, the more dulcet toned than I am tonight, because, well, I sound like a sick Batman. We've got John Champion.
You sound like a sick man. Like, I'm sick Batman.
No, pleasure to be here, guys. And it's a movie. So, looking forward to getting into it.
Is it the movie that, is it the gift that keeps on giving? That's the question. But before we dive into that, the gift that does keep on giving is the 602 Club to you every week, which you can find over there on iTunes. Over on iTunes, you can find all of the shows we do at iTunes.com/TrekFM. And while you're over there, as I said before, make sure you're subscribed to the 602 Club. You can get the show as soon as I publish it. And leave us a star rating and review. And if you do, you will be thanked on the show and your review will be read out to everyone. So you can be internet famous. That's right. You can follow us all over the place. We're on Twitter at TrekFM, Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. We do have a listeners-only discussion group, which is called the Babel Conference. That is housed on Facebook. You can find that by typing Babel into the search field there on the old Facebook. Or maybe you're over at the website at trek.fm and you're perusing show pages. Just hit the discussion button on the menu, and that'll bring you right over there. And then last but not least, maybe you would like to contact the show and you would like to send us an email. Well, we love getting emails here on the show. So go over to trek.fm/contact, choose a show, choose the 602 Club, and that email will come to me and then any hosts that are on that week. So as we mentioned, we're continuing with Bond, and we've got The World Is Not Enough. What's interesting continuing with Bond with this one, guys, is I was kind of shocked when I, you know, usually when I go and do some research and I watch the behind-the-scenes stuff, there's all of these things that have happened. This one, there's very little controversy or trouble that seems to be behind the scenes, which is kind of strange for Bond movies. So instead of having a lot to talk about, you know, there really wasn't, I thought this would be a good section to really kind of talk about the idea that this one continues in the vein of the last film, which kind of took some social commentary, some things that were happening around the world, and that, you know, this story seems to still in some ways be pretty relevant with the idea of interrupting oil supplies and trying to one-up each other in that oil game, which is still such an important thing for us here in the West and around the world. And I thought that that was, you know, if there is one good thing I think I could truly say about the movie is that the plot itself is actually still pretty relevant when it comes to what the villains are after.
I completely agree, Matt, and I'm glad that it's a movie that has this social commentary, like you said, that, you know, it's was relevant, especially then. I remember, even though I was young at the time, you know, the world becoming more aware of A, that oil is not a renewable resource, and B, that we need to be more environmentally conscious about that. And so I did think it was a fascinating, you know, plot to go with because of that, but then also that it was interesting and it gave them a new way to go with the plot of the movie as far as villains go, to not just be something outlandish, something, you know, that's more grounded, and makes sense for when the movie came out. I do want to add that I felt like as far as the behind the scenes interaction between the cast and crew, I think it was great. Obviously, we probably all do, that there wasn't a lot of turmoil this time. And when you watch the behind the scenes with Brosnan especially, it just seemed that everybody jived very well together, and that he said that he was ready to do many more films with this group and to continue his bond. And, you know, as we know, obviously, we get him again in Die Another Day. And so it felt like it, in a good way, that there was nothing exciting going on in that area. And I was glad to hear it.
You know, you talk about the kind of relevance to late 20th century, early 21st century politics and business, the business of energy, and that political landscape where the movie takes place. And I just kept thinking, man, you know, it was only 25 years before that Bond got the Solex Agitator out of the hands of Scaramanga. Where was Bond's commitment to renewable energy resources? You know, why are we still?
He could have already saved the world this problem.
Exactly, man. I mean, what we need next is a villain who's dedicated to wind turbine energy. Maybe another who's dedicated to geothermal. Mm-hmm. You know, so, yeah. That's something that is really good about this movie. I feel like, well, actually, all three of these Brosnan movies that we've looked at so far, there is a sense of place that I really appreciate about these. And I've been kind of, you know, I didn't enjoy GoldenEye as much as I thought I would, though I still like it. I enjoyed Tomorrow Never Dies more than I thought I would, even though it had been my favorite of the Brosnan movies anyway. And each of those movies did a great job of really sort of putting Bond in places that are exotic and interesting and photogenic, but still feel real. All the stuff in St. Petersburg in GoldenEye was pretty amazing. All the sequences, like the helicopter chase, everything with Michelle Yeoh in Tomorrow Never Dies, felt real and grounded. This movie is that first scene of going over the abandoned Soviet oil fields where they've just sort of laid waste to this part of the world. It was really evocative. I really appreciate that Bond sort of swings back and forth on this pendulum between total fantasy, you know, submarine bases and space stations, to something that is tangible and extant.
Well, and this is really a Bond movie where everything in it could happen. There's nothing outrageous happening here. You know, this is all very grounded stuff. And I think if anything can really be said in the movie's favor, that is another really important aspect to this movie, is that there isn't anything like space lasers and, you know, that kind of stuff, where there is this sense that, you know, these things could happen. And I really enjoyed that about the film. And I thought it's well done in that way to give us something that is still relevant even today. But of course, yeah, it's just something for me that I felt was very strong in the film's favor, to give us something that feels down to earth, real, and just what's interesting is that, you know, Pierce Brosnan, I think his films, people have the feeling that they kind of went way more the Roger Moore route. But honestly, in this film, that's not the case. You know, I don't feel like we've gotten to that point yet. You know, we might get there in the next one, possibly. We'll talk about it then. But
who knows?
Only the shadow knows. but this one, I didn't think there was anything just crazy that you couldn't see in reality, which was great. You know, the gadgets all feel, you know, still more down to earth that Bond has. You know, he doesn't get anything from Q that doesn't seem like you couldn't actually make. And he actually doesn't have a ton of gadgets in the movie. You know, I think the craziest gadget may be the X-ray glasses. But that doesn't seem all that far-fetched, really, for Bond. So
it's a little comic booky.
Yeah.
But, like, specifically comic booky.
It does kind of seem like something Iron Man would have.
Yeah.
You could totally see Tony Stark wearing those glasses.
Like, if that were really a thing in 1999, you know, the glasses would look cool, but Bond would also have, like, some computer pack, and it would have, you know, there'd be a camera on it, and you'd see wires and all. But, you know, for the purpose of the movie, sure. Yeah.
But the other side of this movie that I thought was also kind of interesting was that there is, for, I feel like maybe the first time, there's a personal stake for M. Because this story revolves around a friend of hers, and of course, you know, what happened with Electra King, his daughter, in the past. And so this almost seems like, you know, Bond's going on personal vendettas, but this one kind of leaves M to almost want to be on a personal vendetta, which was another nice way to continue Bond and do something that we'd never seen before.
Yeah, I think that for me stole the show more than the whole oil issue, was that M was getting personally involved when usually she's been much more removed and good at being an unbiased, great at her job kind of person. And that she and Bond have that moment before he goes off on the mission where he says, "Are you getting too involved, M?" And she's like, "Don't be insubordinate." And, you know, he's looking at her like, "Who are you to call me insubordinate when you're the one who's getting personal about a mission?" I love that. And I love, too, that really it pulled on my heartstrings, a person like Elektra who had been through what she had been through. I think it's very relatable in a sad way, that kidnappings, unfortunately, happen a lot. And that, you know, she went through being... you know, beaten and people wanting ransom for her. And then later, obviously, we learned getting Stockholm syndrome. It's a tough thing to watch, but it's great as a plot device because then you care so much about her and you don't for one minute think until Bond questions her that she could possibly be another villain.
Yeah, looking at this movie in retrospect after, a couple of years ago that we did all of the Daniel Craig movies where M is really front and center, it was kind of a surprise to go back to this and remember, oh yeah, this is the first time that they really made M a character. Not just sort of the parent figure, the overseer who gives the mission and then is out of the picture. It really was only in License to Kill that Bond and M, we felt, really had any stakes with each other, but then you just don't deal with M anymore after their scene at the Hemingway house. So when we reintroduce M as Judi Dench, I like that they changed their relationship and they gave them this not totally adversarial, but they sort of put them in a position where they had to re-earn each other's respect. So it was cool to see then a new depth added to M and to what she brings to the movies.
Well, and I think that's the thing that was really enjoyable to see in this film. You know, we've had their relationship progressing, and by this movie, you know, you do have where Bond is drawing information out of her, you know, where they're standing there at the Scottish castle, which, what a great place to have, you know, an MI6 lair. And he's making her tell him what had happened. And I thought that was really interesting because there is almost a role reversal in this film for them, where M is the one who is maybe too involved with what's happening, and Bond is the one who's being a little bit more clinical about this and trying to get to the bottom of things, and trying to be slightly more, I don't know what the right word is, but I guess clinical is probably the best word. You know, just do the spy job, get it figured out, and let's move on to the next thing. And I thought that was really nice, you know, because it just adds another layer to their relationship, but it also adds a lot of trust in their relationship, which I thought was great to see here as well. So I thought that was, giving M a bigger part into the story and allowing Judi Dench to do more was fantastic. It's so funny to hear her in interviews. She's so completely the opposite of this character. And being comfortable with anything to do with this, but she plays it so well in the film, you never don't buy her. So I really appreciate that. I wanted to ask you guys something that's not even on the outline, but I was just thinking about this. You know, we've had Pierce now for, this is the third film. And I wanted to ask you just about him and what you thought about his portrayal of this, you know, incredible icon at this point. Three movies in, is he gotten better for you? Has he gotten worse? What do you guys think?
I think that he's only gotten better because you can tell always in an actor's first Bond film specifically that the actor is kind of trying to ease the audience into believing them as the new version of Bond, but also that the writers are trying to ease you into believing them as well. And that by the second and then the third movie, that they're really coming into their own with the character. And I think that, A, I'm a card-toting Pierce Brosnan fan. I will tell you, Thomas Crown Affair.
And it's laminated. Yeah. So.
Thomas Crown Affair is one of my favorite movies of all time. And it's because Pierce Brosnan is so freaking awesome. But he is so believable as Bond. He's got that mystery about him. He's got the sex appeal for sure. And then he can come in and do the serious parts of the role too. And I feel like I said, that he's only gotten better with this character as the films have gone on, even if there are parts of the film that's kind of ridiculous. You know, him driving this jet boat around. I love it, but it comes across a little bit like, really? A little much, but they did an incredible job with it. But I think that it's totally believable that Bond would be able to do that kind of thing and that Pierce does a great job with it.
Yeah, we all said from the beginning that this is the role that Pierce Brosnan was born to play. And, you know, so much relies on the actor, but so much relies on the direction and the writing and the editing and everything that ultimately makes it to the screen. And, you know, you just said that there may be pieces of Pierce Brosnan's portrayal that kind of dip into the Roger Moore style of playing Bond, which is very different from Timothy Dalton, very different from Daniel Craig, very different from Sean Connery, but they all bring their thing. And of course, in OHMSS, George Lazenby, they all bring their thing. They all bring their interpretation. But I think what's been driven home for me, less so because it's less acute, but it's a similar thing to what I said about Roger Moore. The problem with those movies wasn't Roger Moore. Roger Moore was giving it all he had. Roger Moore was actually grounding everything that he was given. Pierce Brosnan is given certain things to do that don't really play true. And, you know, you mentioned the boat scene just now, Christy, and it's very true. Like, that scene for me went on and on and on and on. And the shot of Bond straightening his tie underwater was, it hit me like the triple take pigeon. You know, it was a decision that probably wasn't his, but it was the director, or maybe it was something kind of done like, okay, well, we're in this effect scene and we have this moment where the boat's going to go underwater. We could play this one of several ways. Let's do a take like this, see what we get. And ultimately, the editor and director decide what that pacing and what that scene is going to look like on screen. If it were me, I would have cut it out. But if it were me, I would have cut 5 minutes out of that boat chase anyway. You know, I feel like Brosnan delivers. He delivers all the time, but we can't fault him necessarily for the constructs around him that don't always land, because he's doing his best. And I know that at the time, and even after Die Another Day, I wanted him to do another, just give us one more, or maybe two more. Yeah, we know you got
and
it in you.
I love that he said, like I said, in the interview that he had in Hong Kong, that he wanted to do a million more of these, that he was so comfortable at this point, that he loved working with this director, Michael Apted, and that he loved seeing the stunts that they put together. But I do think that the only fault of the boat scenes was the stunts were great, but they had a little bit too much of the just following of the two boats that could have been cut for time that really wasn't necessary.
No, I agree with both of you. And I think, just to add, I think this is the film where Brosnan feels the most comfortable so far. He really is inhabiting the role. I think he just is Bond at this point. And he feels, you know, pretty confident in everything he does. And I was noticing, and I really enjoyed the scenes with that were much more tense, that were much more emotionally driven, the ones that were a little bit harder edged. I think he does that stuff really well. Some of the stuff with Elektra where they're challenging each other, and also the scenes, you know, where he's being tortured by her, you know, and he's trying not to let her know that it's hurting him, you know, and giving it back to her, basically, of, you know, I don't really care what you're going to do. I'm going to find a way out of this. You know, that kind of attitude, that steel he has, that Remington steel. Mm-hmm. I think he just does a very good job in this movie, but I'll agree with you, John. I think that there are places where the movie undercuts that with some humor that kind of hurts those tension scenes. And it's not his fault. It's just the way in which they do the film. And it's a little bit frustrating. And I'll agree, too. You know, the opening credit sequence, the boat chase just goes on too long. And it becomes the longest opening credit sequence ever, because they were going to cut that down where it was just going to be the part in Spain. And then the other part was going to be later, you know, after the credits. And it was deemed too boring compared to the other Bond movies. So they put in the boat chase. There's nothing wrong with that boat chase. The boat's cool. What's happening is cool. You're just, like you said, Christy, you're allowing the chase part where you're just seeing the boats follow each other last way too long. Mm-hmm. And the part where, you know, Bond is making his way across, you know, which doesn't even make sense. You know, you really lose all reality at that point that, you know, the boat is out of the water, but still somehow it's going, you know, like, all that stuff, you know, if you really cut this down and just got to that point where he has the confrontation with the balloon and then falls and then hurt his shoulder, all that stuff is great, you know. I love that he gets hurt in this movie. Mm-hmm. you know, and that it's kind of a constant reference of, oh, he's got this shoulder thing. And you'll even see him fall in certain scenes in other parts of the movie and he winces, you know. So they keep that going. All that stuff is good. It's just, yeah, Brosnan is undercut by some of the things that they decide to do here in the film. And I
see the opening scene in the Swiss banker's office, I thought, was tremendous. Like, they did such a good job of building the tension, and you really felt like he was in danger. Of course, you know that he's not, but what a great thing. A little office, a few floors up, the doors are locked, there's three guys in there, and then you have the authorities coming, and you've got to get out of there with the briefcase. Like, all of that stuff was great real-world spy stuff, or imagined version of real-world spy stuff. Then you get back to MI6, and you just mentioned it, you know, as soon as that boat gets on land, and it's not like the scene from Live and Let Die, where it just has to make a crossing and then get to the other side where the river picks up again. This is like, I go back to Moonraker. It's like, is he now on a hovercraft?
Right.
is there something that I missed here about a feature of this boat? Where are the wheels? There have to be wheels.
And I will add, too, that I was thinking, even rewatching the beginnings of that whole boat scene, you're thinking, okay, why doesn't he just, clearly he has the speed advantage in that mini boat. He could just drive it up on the back of her boat and then solve the problem, you know, either run her over or drive it up there and then kill her. But like, come on, why are you extending this? Why can't he just do that? But I do agree that it driving the boat through town didn't make sense, because you're thinking, now it's a duck boat, you know, it's an amphibiboat is my word. It kind of takes away from it, but I do want to give it credit for the barrel roll that they do in the smaller boat, because I watched all of the behind the scenes on how the stunt was done, and the stunt coordinator, Simon Crane, was so funny, because a reporter asked him, what do you do if you break the boat? And he goes, well, we're not breaking the boat, but we have six of them. But it.
Well, and that is the thing. I mean, that chase doesn't look fake.
No,
that's the best part about it. You know, except for Pierce Brosnan underwater
and the drive through town
tie. Other than that, the chase does not look fake. It is all real, in the sense that, you know, this boat exists, they created it, you know, and they're actually doing the chase down the Thames, which is fantastic. It's just they have allowed themselves to become so enamored with the scene that they're not willing to cut it down to where it needs to be to actually make it tight and really flow well, so that you do feel more tension, other than like, oh, well, I guess I could get more popcorn now, you know. You never want an action scene to go on to that point, you know, and they just do. I will say that I think with the villain, I think this is another place where they actually hurt themselves by trying to go so exotic and honestly old school Roger Moore style villain, where there's some weird thing about them that they actually hurt the believability of the villain. And it also, it undercuts him in a lot of ways by just making him less menacing, because, you know, I don't care if you can't feel things because there's a bullet in your brain. It's, you can't just pick up a freaking rock that's, you know, bloody hot and not have your hand be scarred. You might not feel it, but your hand ain't going to be normal.
Right, it would at least be burnt.
Yes.
Yeah, he's going to need some kind of a wound dressing either way. Yeah, I mean, look, I don't think it's a terrible idea just to give him something. You know, to make him a little more menacing, to make him a little different, like that's all fine. But I felt like they tried to do too much with that. And they tried to weave it into this guy's personal philosophy, you know, about how he doesn't feel. And that I felt also kind of undermined his quote-unquote relationship with Elektra. So if you just, like, look, if you take a guy like Jaws and you just say, okay, here's this giant mute thing that is terrifying and menacing and comes after you, and he's almost impenetrable because you will hurt yourself more than him when you try to engage. Okay, I actually believe that more. But I think they tried to take Renard a little too far. And even his suicide mission, again, it was a psychological thing for him too, because he was driven by this idea that he can't feel anything, but he feels something for Elektra, or at least her cause, so he's going to do this because he's dying anyway. It was a little too layer upon layer upon layer, where I feel like they were trying to be deep and didn't quite land.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that too, John, because I felt like that always seemed a little weak. That why does he care so much about, although he's dying, ensuring Elektra's future, but it sounds like he's trying to destroy the entire planet. So how would she have a future? I don't get it. And the other thing that bothered me too was, if you have to explain before you even meet your villain all of this stuff about him to then explain what his motivations are, I felt like that was a little too much background information. You need to be showing me, not telling me, kind of thing.
Yeah.
The whole thing about, then if it gets really muddy between him and Elektra, and we'll completely just talk about her in a minute, but, you know, he's kidnapped her, and then in the end, you can't really tell who's manipulating who in this, and maybe that's good, but maybe that's bad, and I don't know, it just became so muddy, I didn't really care, and it kind of hurt the motivation for me with caring about Elektra, like you were saying earlier, to where I really did want to kind of connect, obviously, with what had happened to her, and, you know, this whole thing about her being kidnapped, and, you know, you get this feeling like she's been psychologically tortured and possibly raped, and, you know, that's all awful, and it's a actually good setup to create this villain of this person you really are supposed to hate, but he's so silly as a character with this, you know, as we were talking about this thing where there's this bullet in his brain that's slowly traveling towards the center, and it just doesn't even make sense medically whatsoever.
Why hasn't it stopped?
Right?
Why? Yeah.
How is it still moving?
Why does
it's been there a long time.
Yeah. I mean, is there some sort of magnet at the middle of his brain that's pulling it in? It just doesn't make a lot of sense. And it undercuts, like, the seriousness of what they've created, which is this awful, awful terrorist, this anarchist who, you know, has stolen this, you know, girl, this kidnapped this girl and done all these horrible things to her. But by the end of the movie, you don't feel like anything really happened to her. Like, you don't feel like any of that was true. You don't, it was just all a ruse. And it's like it undercuts the villain completely. And it also makes her a weaker villain in the end, too, because she's actually the other villain.
Well, yeah, I know you've got show notes here, but it seems like you've kind of segued into the next
segment
here to talk about the women.
Yeah, let's talk about her.
Yeah, because I really have mixed feelings about the character. Not Sophie Marceau. I think she's everything that you would want in a Bond woman, in a foil for Bond and a lover for Bond. She's beautiful, she's sophisticated, she's mysterious, and she plays the range of emotions in this, and the manipulation is great. I remembered from seeing it originally that, yes, I was fooled for a moment that she was not the bad guy. Going back to rewatch it for this, of course, I knew going into it what the twist was with her. And the thing that I appreciated, but also kind of felt uneasy from this movie, is that they really tried to go to a dark place. And, you know, I take my hat off to the Bond producers and writers for doing that. There are some dark themes here for her. There is the torture that she went through, the hatred that she has for the people around her. There are these dark areas about rape and abuse and the Stockholm syndrome, although a little strange that Bond just comes right out and says it in this sort of the exposition moment of the film. But at the same time, I sat there wondering, are we just painting a slightly more complex version of this, you know, tortured woman trope who then has to take it out on everybody around her? And I kept wanting for the character to be even deeper and even more sophisticated and even more even more empathetic or something else to be there with her than I actually got out of this. So it's like they got me there halfway, and then it's just like, okay, well, is she just the mustache twirling bad guy because she has these issues with the other people in her life? And then we're gonna, you know, leave her dead on the bed there in her lair.
John, so, nobody can resist her. Nobody, nobody can resist her.
The fact that she said, "Oh, that drove me nuts. That drove me nuts." Just cut that line right out of the movie. Show it. Yep. Don't tell it.
You know. And see, I,
because at that exact moment, Bond was resisting her. So it's like you're,
yeah. Just stop. Just stop.
But I will say I kind of chalked up any inconsistency with her to just her having gone completely off the deep end crazy at this point. That was my suspension of disbelief with it. And I think what really cemented that for me was that it was so creepy when she's running up the staircase from Bond and says, "You can't kill me, not in cold blood." It was just, I mean, blood curdling for me. That she just looks like she's an insane person at this point and is running toward the next thing. And I like that they have Bond go there and shoot her right in the face. I mean, he didn't shoot her in the face, but, you know, mm-hmm. he's facing her when he shoots her. Because although he does have a good side, he does have a license to kill and at this point has every reason to kill her. So you don't feel bad that she dies.
But I think to your point, though, the reason it feels so weird is just like at that point, it just feels like he's killing this mm-hmm. brat. You know, like we know he can do it. You know, we know Bond can kill in cold blood. We know that Bond is going to finish the job. But at that moment, he's just killing this brat who's this sort of damaged little girl. As opposed to the mastermind that I wanted her to be. So it all of this and the character stuff kept going back and forth for me, where I was like, oh, yeah, we're going to see a formidable Bond woman here who is the bad guy. It's okay that she's the bad guy. That's fine. And she's got a scheme. She's got a plot here. She's manipulating things as best she can. She is supposedly a step ahead. And when Bond challenges the first time and she turns it around, great. These are the building blocks for something interesting here. But it just doesn't end up being what I think it could have or should have been.
Well, they just undercut her by making her crazy pants instead mm-hmm. of keeping her sane.
Hey, someone had to shut her up.
Yeah.
And the way that they do that is by suspending your disbelief that, one, maybe she was even tortured in the first place and that she's just this whole mastermind that nobody can resist her, you know, then having her be somebody who's truly turned basically to the dark side through Stockholm Syndrome and muddling all of her motivation. You don't feel like that she has anything. The motivations just feel completely off because all of that has just stirred this stew and you're not sure where she's coming from anymore. And it's just frustrating because, you know, I think the excitement of having a Bond woman actually be the full-on final villain, like the true villain, is actually a really smart thing to do. And yet they take her in a way that kind of cheapens that, and that's really frustrating, especially when this is Sophie Marceau, who is such a great actress, and she could pull this off, but then they just take her into, you know, bratty crazy pants land. And, you know, by going to bratty crazy pants land, you ruin the effect that you were actually going for. And that is just definitely frustrating, because Bond deserves to have, I think, a very strong female villain one day, where you really do feel like Bond, when he does kill her, is justified, and you don't feel like there should be any of that, you know, male on female violence in that sense, because she truly is a foil for Bond as the villain and his equal in that way. You want that, but like you get to this point where he kills her, and it's just like, shouldn't they just put her in a sane asylum? You know, really, isn't that what they really should do? Is just, you know, because yeah, you get to that moment where he kills her, and it's like,
You feel a little unfulfilled.
I feel like she just needs a lot of therapy.
Yeah, that too.
Which is kind of, I mean, that's boring, but yeah.
But the rest of the time, I did really love her portrayal and the way they wrote the character up to that point.
Yeah, before that, it was very interesting because they were adding some interesting layers about her anger at her father, and, you know, her siding with her mother's people, and that really that's where the fortune had come from. So that was all, I think that was all fascinating. I mean, those are great layers to write in and make her this complex character. I think they make her so complex she becomes simple, in the sense that they give her so much motivation that you don't know if there's any motivation anymore, because you're not really sure who she is as a character. And it's like you're just trying to cram too much into one character, and they needed to be able to find a simpler through line for her. And in fact, I feel like...
And I want that through line to not just be a woman scorned, right, or a woman with daddy issues.
Yes, because I feel like if you had actually tweaked the writing so that when she was taken by Renard, she formed a relationship with him, in the sense that he cultivated that hate in her about her father and everything, and that's what the turn came from. And, you know, it became about this ethnicity and all that kind of stuff, and taking that kind of... I you just could have really done something unique and different, but they didn't. Which leads us to, you know, Christmas Jones and Denise Richards. And I'm wondering if her playing an American nuclear physicist, was that, you know, different and you know, really stalwart places we needed to go in this film as our second Bond woman.
I really don't see the point in her character. And this is nothing against Denise Richards. This is just for Dr. Christmas Jones being in the movie at all. I feel like there were two reasons they added her in. One is to have somebody who's a specialist on nuclear physics to talk intelligently about what was going on with the weapons, but two, to stand there and look hot. And that's why they called Denise Richards, which she did great. But as far as the acting goes, I felt like she was a little wooden.
Yeah, I can't really say it any better than that. Denise Richards, again, is nothing against her, because I remember shortly after this movie came out, I can't remember the exact year. Fortunately, I have a database in front of me that shows me all movies. It's connected to the internet, too. So, Undercover Brother, 2002, she played White She-Devil. And she was hilarious.
Funny in that. She was,
yes,
really funny in
she
that.
Was hilarious and sexy, and it had this, you know, spy vibe, exploitation movie send up thing. It was perfect. It was absolutely perfect for her. In this role, I cringed at the time, and I cringe now.
You cringed and you cringed again. You Wait, cringed what's that? And you cringed again.
I cringed and I cringed again, yeah. To what you said, it just feels like whoever wrote this felt like, well, we have our main Bond woman, but she's the bad guy, so we have to have somebody else. And honestly, I thought all the scenes of Bond with the doctor from MI6 were far more believable and far more interesting than anything mm-hmm. with Christmas Jones. And I know that they just played that off for like the cheap sex gag that it was. Still better. And I would have just rather have seen a return of her character than Dr. Christmas Jones. And look, none of this is to say that you can't be young and beautiful and smart and be a nuclear physicist or whatever. You can be all of those things. Go right ahead. I did not buy it in this movie, and I did not buy it in this particular role.
I heartily agree that Serena Scott Thomas as the doctor was much more believable and had much more chemistry with Pierce Brosnan. I mean, that scene is it is kind of silly, but it's electrically sexy. Mm-hmm. You can tell. And what I thought was actually kind of great about that scene, it's totally a throwaway, really, because he's You kind of got the feeling like they've done it before. Uh-huh. Like this is a pattern with them, you know, and, you know, they work together and it's never going to be more because it can't be more because if she got found out, she would definitely get in trouble. You know, there's all that going on. And of course, Moneypenny knows, which that made for some fun jokes, but, you know.
Yeah, she's pretty much there to feed that moment with Moneypenny, which is fine. And I liked Samantha Bond more in this as Moneypenny mm-hmm. than I had before.
Well, I mean, close, but no cigar. Mm-hmm. But yes, Denise Richards is woefully miscast here. And reportedly who they were thinking about casting of Jerry Halliwell or maybe Tiffany Amber Thiessen. I mean, does not help that they were ever thinking about this role as anything. You know, they're not aiming high with this character. They're it's the lowest common denominator. Denise Richards is beautiful, but I mean, she's not the character you need for this role. You need somebody who can really act the part of, you know, as she said, Richards stated she liked the character because she was brainy and athletic and had depth of character. Well, the character on the page may have that, but you didn't add any of that, unfortunately.
Right.
And so, and in fact, you took that all away. And it's just because this is not the role for her. And so, again, Denise Richards was fantastic when her blackness was confirmed. She had soul and Undercover Brother. You know, I mean, she was amazing in that movie. She's so good at comedic stuff. But here, yeah, I mean, her, you know, fake disgust over Electra King and Bond being with her and all that stuff. It just, nothing about the character works whatsoever, and it's very frustrating. So
and even just the name, it felt like in the past, you know, the Bond women names could be pretty perverse in a funny way, obviously, like the Holly Goodhead and, you know, all of that, but felt like they were trying to be a little safe but still have something funny. But you saw the joke coming the first time they said her name. If her name is Christmas, at some point they're going to make a joke about opening the presents. Mm-hmm. Ha ha ha. Mm-hmm.
And she even says that. She even says, I've heard all the jokes. So, come on.
But they still do it
I
at the end.
I don't know any doctor jokes. That was actually the best joke about her name. I don't know any doctor jokes.
Yeah.
I mean, they should have just stuck with that. But of course, you know, the last line in this movie may be more egregious than what we get at the end of Moonraker. Well, he's attempting re-entry, sir.
Yeah.
I'm not sure which is worse.
Right.
So, and that's saying something.
All of the above.
All of the
just
above.
Just that they're all the worst.
I do. Okay, so a quick side before we get to Q. What did you think about the cigar joke with Moneypenny?
Oh, I loved it.
Yeah, look, I mean, it's one of those traditions in Bond movies that you just can't give up. You have to have the tension, the flirtation between Bond and Moneypenny, and they're just going to keep finding those moments and playing them, some more extreme than others. Go to it.
Well, and I mean, you know, I guess if you're making fun of Bill Clinton, it's allowed.
Yeah. Know. And she tosses it.
Yeah.
Good for her.
It is. It is great. Yeah. I agree with you too, John. I really appreciated her in this role. She has a small role here, but I thought her and Bond had some fun together in that, and I liked her little bits in this film. I just thought it was enjoyable. I wanted to ask you guys about saying goodbye to Q, because this is Desmond Llewellyn's last film, and he was already retiring from the role because he was just getting too old to play it. And sadly, he would die in a car crash not long after the premiere. Do you feel as though he got the right send-off?
I do. I think that I felt it coming, even though I knew, obviously, I had seen the film before and knew the history of Desmond Llewellyn. You get the feeling when you're watching his scenes with Bond, when he first comes in, that, A, you can see Desmond's age in this movie at this point in his life. And then B, you can tell that, he's mentioning his retirement when he says, "You ruined my retirement vessel." But it still every time makes me emotional. Like I felt like I was going to cry when he said, "Always have an escape plan," and then just slowly lowers into the ground. You feel like you're losing him at that point. In general. And so it really was a sweet way of handling it. I felt like it was appropriate and really gave him a lot of clout and didn't just dismiss him. But great to bring in John Cleese. I don't know who else I would have used at this point to possibly replace Q. And so I think that it they picked the perfect person to come in, and then making the joke of him as being R and being the butt of the joke that he's never going to be as good as Q was cute.
I agree that, that send off of him going down the elevator was perfectly shot. It was perfectly acted. It was poignant. It was a really nice moment for them to have in there. And you really felt Desmond Llewellyn's age in this, more so than even in the last movie. It's just something changed, and suddenly he felt a lot older than the old man that he already was. I do wish, though, that they had separated his scenes with the John Cleese scenes as R. I don't know what the right answer to that is. I don't know how structurally I would have done it or how I could think through it, but I wanted Q to just have his moments on his own. And, John Cleese, pretty much wherever he shows up, he's going to upstage everybody because he's John Cleese, So I would have liked to have seen a bit of separation there. But even though you introduce R in a completely silly way with him having his lab coat stuck in the door and all that, he absolutely turns it around and gets to have his quips with Bond. And that is the right tone that we expect, that was established by Desmond Llewellyn, 47 years prior to this.
I agree with you, John. I do think that they needed to find a way to have more separation in those scenes so you could really feel Llewellyn's last moment. I am glad that Cleese was there, because I now know how to finally put on a jacket. And so I really appreciate that.
Right arm first, left arm second.
Yeah.
I'm going to disagree with both of you, though. I don't think John Cleese was the right choice. Mm-hmm. I feel that he's too silly. Desmond Llewellyn was never silly. He took the job very seriously, and from the beginning he was somebody who was the straight man. John Cleese is not the straight man, he's the joke man. And I feel like setting that up, you set a bad precedent for the idea of the Q branch, and so that it's just kind of the joke. Whereas, Desmond Llewellyn always, he I never joke about my work, 007, like that's who he was. And so I was disappointed actually with this point of the film and R, and of course what we get in Die Another Day, but again, we'll talk about that later. So I just didn't feel like that was the right choice, but that's just me. So,
well, no, see, I see where you're coming from, because they give him a lot of silly, you know, opening with the coat stuck in there and then him getting caught in the giant inflatable ball. They give him a lot of silly. I think the only thing that redeems it at all is that he shows Bond that he can give as good as he can get. So he is there with right. The barbs, and John Cleese in a lot of his comedic acting work has been able to do that, where there'll be something silly and out of control, but then he'll turn it right back around and he's got the upper hand. Do they take it a step too far here? Yes. And I guess we'll see what happens, speaking of a step too far, in the next movie. Stay tuned.
And I will add, Matt, if you remember, I don't remember exactly which Roger Moore film it was, but there was a moment at the end where Bond is in the pool with the woman and Q is watching from the balcony like a creeper.
Oh, yes.
So he does have his moments. It's a Dalton
movie, isn't it? License to Kill.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All in all, though, I do think his last moment is quite wonderful, and it is a good way to remember him. You know, being able to go out like that and to go out on his terms. It's great that he got that opportunity. I wanted to ask you guys about a Bond ally that we got back in the film, Robbie Coltrane as Valentin Sukovsky, and you know, at this point, just another person that helps out Bond. And I wanted to know how you guys thought and what you guys thought about him being back and kind of just being in Bond's camp at this point. I mean, he's a little antagonistic, but for the most part, he's really just here to help Bond. And again, another character that they kind of put firmly into the comedy camp for the most part.
I will say the one weakness I felt with Valentin's character was that they don't ever really explain the issue where Elektra bets $1 million and loses, and then later Bond confronts Valentin about it, and they still don't really explain how Valentin and Elektra possibly knew each other prior. So I felt like that was a little bit of a weak point in the plot, but otherwise, I absolutely love Robbie Coltrane, and I love him as Valentin. I really like the back and forth that he and Bond have, that they're not just, oh, best friends forever and always kind to each other. I like that every time we see him with Bond, Bond's coming in with a gun pointed in his face, and Valentin's going, whoa, hey, hold on a minute, I didn't do anything. But you know he's always a little bit of a, you know, dirty guy. I mean, heck, this time when we first see Valentin, he's got a woman on either side of his desk. So you know that he's not this squeaky clean guy. He's also running his own casino and saying, make sure they lose all their money in this one.
Yeah, I got no complaints there. I mean, Robbie Coltrane was so good in Goldeneye in this character, and it's really nice to see him back. And it's nice to see Bond have to deal with people who are on his side only because, well, it's, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. You know, it's instead of just being purely good guy, bad guy, black and white, it's nice to see Bond have to navigate this in between kind of gray world. And Robbie Coltrane just chews scenery whenever he's on. So, yeah, I would have liked to have seen more of him, but he got an honorable way out. You know, he was in the mix, in the action.
And he may not actually be dead.
Oh.
Yeah, that's very true.
It's like the Mace
actually,
Windu of Bond.
I mean, we never see him die. We just see that he passes out. So,
and he got a shot in before he went out, too.
A good one, too.
The I like him in this movie. I think he's funny, you know, and he does, I think, add the right kind of humor to the film, personally. It's the only thing I would say is in that moment with Elektra, where he comes in and it becomes a comedy moment where he's like, I'm looking for a submarine. It's big and it's black. And, you know, the driver is a very good friend of mine. It takes that moment that had such tension and completely alleviates it. And that's not exactly what I wanted in that moment, especially as Bond's neck's about to be snapped.
Yeah.
And I wish that it had been... There had not been a joke there and that, you know, his kind of rise up wasn't so over dramatic, you know, as he rises up and he, you know, he points it at her and then he brings it over. Like, it's just, it's very cliched. And I think it does hurt the moment there. But otherwise, everything else he's doing, especially when he's hanging out with Bond, I really appreciate that. Especially as they just start drinking together and they're talking about everything. And, you know, there is that sense of, like you said, John, they have become close because the enemy of my enemy is my friend. But in some ways, they don't want to admit that they've become friends. And that's kind of funny. So I enjoy that.
And don't you love the joke, too? Sorry, Matt. I had to throw in when he's in the muck floating around and Bond's questioning him. And he says, "You're going to make me drown in my own caviar." I loved it.
That was actually nice. And I did like, you know, Bond is cold. If he didn't tell him what he wanted to know, he might have let him die, you know. So there is that edge to Bond I really enjoy in this film. You see it every once in a while, and I really appreciate Pierce kind of bringing that. What did you guys think about the action in the movie? I mean, we've got more skiing. We get chased by helicopters with giant spinning tree cutters. You know, you have a BMW Z8 that they malign in a way that should be against all that is holy. I mean, it's just, it is wrong. It is so wrong what they do to that car. How did the action in this Bond movie live up for you guys?
I said at the beginning, the boat chase really drives me nuts. Not because the boat isn't cool, not because they don't get good stunts in there. It just goes on, and it really stretches credibility at a certain point. I need Bond to go up to a point. I need them to cross the line, but then I need them to kind of bring it back and still tell me that I'm in the real world in terms of Bond world, you know? The boat going across so many lanes of traffic and through buildings and all. It's just like, come on, guys, we can stop this. The ski chase stuff was good. The only bit that I didn't like was Bond ripping one of the parachutes with his ski, but then somehow floating right off of that parachute and doing a perfect landing instead of getting tangled up in there, which is what would have really happened. Even the I thought the stuff on the submarine was pretty cool, just because it's an interesting environment to throw them, not only to have this stolen sub, but to have it upended and have to do that final bit of action like that, I thought was a pretty clever use of the set. However, I feel like a lot of these action scenes, a lot of these set pieces, it was a lot of just going from one place to another. And that's part of the problem with the movie, is just like, you know, oh, okay, well, we're in an oil field now. And, now we have to be inside the oil pipeline, which is something Bond did a few movies ago, but this time for a different reason. Now we're on a submarine because we have a submarine. You know, it's just sort of just jumping from one place to another, because partly out of obligation to show the audience, here's a different set piece, here's a different action piece, here's a different set piece, here's a different action piece. They work because Bond always does a good job with action, but some of it feels like it's by rote.
Yeah, I agree with you there, John, for the jumping around, for sure. It felt like, well, we need to fit all of these locations in, so we're going to do it, even at the detriment to the film. But I did like the ski chase, aside from the things that you mentioned. And I love Elektra's ski outfit. I really want it.
Nice.
Just going to throw that out there. And I like the idea that there are these tree saws that hang down from a helicopter, but I don't think that really exists, or that it's even possible. And it really kind of just becomes the shotgun over the fireplace, where you see it at the beginning and you're going, okay, someone's going to either die with that later, or they're going to cut something in half with it. You just know they're going to bring it back later. So it felt a little unnecessary to even have them in the movie. But otherwise, I think that you know, the gadgets were great. I really enjoyed the things that they put in the car. Using the submarine, I think that although that scene felt a little long with Bond and Renard and Christmas, that it was interesting and that it would be difficult to have a fight in a sinking submarine. So it was cool, but it was a little bit too long, and some parts felt a little too implausible to me, especially Bond swimming out from one hole of the submarine and then back into another, mm-hmm. and her having to open the door. There were a lot of doors opening and closing, and I didn't know where people are going to or from.
Right. And I will say this, a BMW Z8 way sexier than a Z3.
Oh, it's amazing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That car also retains its value. Apparently, right now, the lowest you can buy one is for, I think, 169,000.
What?
So, yeah.
Just outside of my budget.
I don't have a lot to say about the action. I'm just going to say this. Apparently, Bond eats vanilla because this is a vanilla action film. None of them feel exciting. There's nothing really happening in them that Bond, it's vanilla. That's all I got. You know, yeah. I'm sorry. So
you're not wrong.
Let's move on to music and theme.
Yeah.
And I want to hear what you guys think about that. I'll start real quick, and I got to say, I think David Arnold knocks it out of the park again with the music. I do think that the soundtrack is fantastic. It feels like classic Bond. You know, it's great action music, so there's nothing wrong with that. The only thing wrong is that they got the wrong artist to sing this song. The song is not bad. You just needed somebody who could really bite into the song and sing it, like a Shirley Bassey kind of thing, or I don't know, but it's not the song that's the problem. I feel like garbage, well, it was a garbage rendition.
Oh, I disagree. I liked it, and I recognized it again when I was listening to it, and then I said, I know that voice, and sure enough, it was Garbage the band, and I actually like them, so I thought it was a beautiful rendition, and I liked the way that they did it.
Yeah, I remember, Christy, I'm on your side on this one. I remember listening to Garbage, you know, for a few years before this movie came out and thinking, man, Shirley Manson has got a really cool voice, mm-hmm. and I like the sound of this band. I would love for them to do a Bond theme. Because, I mean, look, we came off of Tomorrow Never Dies having a great song that was not the theme song, and then a terrible song that was the theme song. For this one, it, no pun intended, hit all the right notes for me. That is exactly the sound that I wanted out of a contemporary rock band doing a Bond theme. I got nothing to add to that, but it is one of my favorites. Yeah. Sorry, Matt.
That's okay. That's okay. You know, I think it's great when we have, you know, different opinions, honestly. I think it makes for a much more, you know, interesting conversation. And I'm glad it worked for you guys better than it did for me. So, you know, I'm just glad that the music, you know, didn't sound like GoldenEye mm-hmm. again. So
hear, hear.
Thank the maker for that. I guess the last question is, was the world enough for you guys? What is your rating for The World Is Not Enough?
Oh, it's kind of difficult because there were a lot of drawbacks, but I did enjoy it more on the rewatch than I thought that I would. So I'm going to kind of put it in the middle for me and give it a 6 out of 10 tree saws. Because there were a lot of things that I surprisingly still liked. I think that the villain, woman this time instead of just a man was great. I think that Sophie did a great job as this character that was troubled but also had a good side. and fooling Bond, and especially on your first time seeing this movie, fools the audience into thinking she couldn't be a bad guy. I love that for M, something gets personal and that she even gets out on the field. And you're thinking, no, M, don't do it. What if you die? We'd have no one to give the missions. And I like a lot of the action sequences, even though some of them could get a little silly with the boats. I still think the stunts were great. And credit to the stunt guy for doing that barrel roll in the boat. I couldn't do that. And then last but not least, I have to add in that I still love Valentin Zukovsky, and I hope maybe at some point we'll get a similar character again. So yeah, 6 out of 10 for me.
So unfortunately, this is a Bond movie that when it came out, I was so underwhelmed that I had only seen it once. So when it hit theaters, that was my first and only time watching this movie in its entirety, you know, as a set thing, watching from beginning to end. I'd seen many, many pieces of it over the years, but that was the first time until now that I had just watched it in its entirety, uninterrupted from beginning to end. And I remembered why. It's because to me, this movie commits the ultimate sin of Bond movies, which is that it was boring to me. I never felt engaged in the characters, and I really wanted to. I was so intrigued with the idea of the Elektra character. I was intrigued at the darkness they were going for, and I wanted to see Pierce Brosnan in something other than what we had just seen him do in his first two movies. And I loved that we incorporated M, and I thought some of the locations here were great. But like I said before, talking about the action sequences, it just feels like we're going from one place to another without a lot of sort of emotional meat to sink my teeth into. There are good moments. There are really good moments here, but they don't tie up to make a total package for me. And I don't think it's Pierce Brosnan's fault. I don't think it's Sophie Marceau's fault, certainly not Dame Judi Dench's fault. And we get to see other ancillary characters that I like. I like Samantha Bond here as Moneypenny. I like Tanner. I like Colin Salmon. You know, these are all good people. I just feel like they didn't quite put together the movie to fit all of this. So, you know, the things that I like in this, I like a lot, but at the end of the day, this is not a movie that I'm going to go back and watch, really. So I'm going to give it 3 X-ray sunglasses out of 10.
This is a Christmas present that should have stayed unwrapped. it should never have been bought as a Christmas present. And I can't really add anything to what you said, John. I think you said it eloquently. So for me, I will say this is 5 out of 10 unwrapped Christmas presents. It's just so, like, it wants to be better than it is, but it's just so baseline mediocre. You know, it's just so in the middle, which makes it vanilla, you know? And so it's disappointing. And it's disappointing because, well, what we have looming is possibly disappointing as well. But we'll see as we die another day next time on the 602 Club. I want to thank you guys for joining me. I love getting to do these shows. They're some of the shows I look forward to the most. Thank you so much to Ken Tripp and Davis Grayson and Daniel Noah for supporting us over on Patreon here as associate producers. Track FM is a huge network, and we can't do this without you. So we do ask you, go over to patreon.com/trackfm and see how you could become part of our team today and really help all of these shows keep coming to you. We cannot do it alone. It's just too expensive. So again, we ask you to go over to patreon.com/trackfm. A little bit every month helps. It really does. So go over there and become part of our team and help make sure all of the Track FM shows come to you each and every week. Guys, I love this. It truly is an honor for me to do these shows with you.
Christy, let everybody know where they can find you and hit you up online with all the things that you've got going on, because you've got a lot going on.
Thanks, Matt. Of course, you guys know you can always find me here often on the 602 Club, doing the Bond films as well as the other geek topics, TV shows, books. And then I am on a monthly show with my friend Teresa Delgado called Galactic Fashion on the Jedi News Network. And then I also sometimes write for StarWarsReport.com. And you can find me online at Bespin Bell on Twitter and Instagram, as well as Galactic Fashion on Twitter and Galactic Fashion Pod on Instagram.
And John Champion, where can everybody find you, sir?
Best place to find me would be through Roddenberry Podcast Network, podcast.roddenberry.com, where you'll be linked up to Mission Log and Mission Log Live and the other shows that we do. And if you're looking for me personally, well, Twitter at DVDGeeks, right? You know, pop in occasionally. Or on Instagram, you can find me there as Slow Mo Gentleman.
Woo!
That's Slow Mo Gentleman. Ah, gosh. You can find me on Twitter, MattRushing02. I'm also on Instagram under the same name. I'm here on the network doing The Orb with Chris Jones, talking about Star Trek Deep Space Nine. I've got a couple of shows over on the Nerd Party Network. I've got Owlpost with Drea Kaufman talking about the Harry Potter series, one chapter at a time. And then I've got Aggressive Negotiations with John Mills talking about Star Wars each and every week. We just pick a crazy topic that we've been thinking about and discuss that. It's a lot of fun. And then last but not least, doing Cinema Stories with my good friend Courtney, all about films through the lens of faith. But thank you so much for joining us. And y'all come back now, you hear?